Hello and welcome to Serious Inquiries Only. This is episode 357. I'm your host, Thomas Smith, here, and I'm excited to get you part two on quantum computing. This part is about the current state of things. And if you're not in the know here, it might not be what you think. It's kind of interesting. I was blown away by some of this information. Excited to get you back over with our expert, Anne, who I'd love to tell you more about, but I don't know because she works in the government and can't really tell us. But she can tell us what she thinks about quantum computing and the current state of things. And so why don't we get right on over to that? Here we go. This was a struggle, and I apologize, but now let's just talk about that. I think I'm following at least enough to know the things we're talking about here, and you're saying this doesn't exist yet, but I thought that I saw a picture of a refrigerator, of a dill fridge. Am I being a real dill fridge, or did I see a picture of a quantum computer, or is that fake?
So we have quantum computers in the sense that we have qubits, so like we can take a CD-ROM, and you can read out a one or a zero, and you can encode that as your superconducting phase, or your photon polarization, or you could use a trapped ion, whatever your flavor of choice is to have a qubit.
Okay.
Those exist. But we are not at the point where somebody has built a quantum computer that could demonstrate Grover's algorithm, and certainly not Shor's algorithm.
We haven't even gotten to Shor's algorithm. Okay.
Well, I don't know if probably a lot of people out there have heard of Shor's algorithm.
No,
because
figure that no, even if someone's heard of it, it doesn't. is it Pauly Shor? Is that who's?
Have you heard about how, quantum computers are going to break all your passwords?
Yes.
That's Shor's algorithm.
Oh, okay. So that's specific. That's not just like by default, any quantum computer would be so cool that it would be able to break all that stuff. That's specifically Howard Shor's algorithm that whatever. You tell me which Shor it is, but that's a specific kind of these logic gates that we haven't implemented yet, or nobody's successfully implemented yet.
They've implemented the gates.
Okay.
They don't have enough qubits to do the algorithm.
Okay. Gotcha.
I'm going to look up what Shor's name is.
Have a qubit, buddy. I was trying to, Pauly Shor is such a dated reference, but like.
Oh, and it's from the 90s too. So it really does fit.
Yeah. Now that the two people from Encino Man have won Oscars, maybe Encino, maybe Pauly Shor, who was in Encino Man, maybe that's going to make a comeback. We'll see. I mean, he's next.
Oh,
he could be
due.
The next for an Oscar.
It's Peter Shor.
Okay. So different Shor.
Different Shor.
Okay. Well, we solved that one. So what's the world record for qubits now? How many qubits has anybody got on the ship anyhow?
I believe that's somewhat controversial because I have people who get, you'd be surprised how sensitive people can get.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Qubit envy. I'm not asking for, like a subpoena or anything, like just roughly. Are we talking like five or like a million? Like what is the...
I believe we're solidly into the dozens.
Dozens? Okay.
I know that there's claims of sometimes, we have 10 qubits, but or 100 qubits, but it's really like, 10 qubits over here and 10 qubits over here. And if we had two 10-qubit computers talking to each other, does that constitute a 20-qubit computer? And I'm not taking a side on that debate.
What is the equivalent, roughly, classical computing power of 10 qubits? Like, are
not
we in
much.
Like 1987 or are we in now? Like, what? How do you translate that?
Yeah, the thing about it is that it doesn't translate very well because if you get a quantum computer to say calculate, 3 times 2, it's not going to do it as well as a classical computer because classical computers are very good at that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, yeah, okay. So classical computers will still handle the easy stuff probably.
And the stuff that fits into their world, calculating this number times this other number. I don't see a world where a quantum computer would ever take that over from a classical computer because that is a sort of calculation that lends itself very well to logic gates.
Yeah.
To quote quantum computing for babies again, what doesn't lend itself so well to classical bits is starting with 6 and asking what the factors are. That's when you need something like a search algorithm, and quantum computers are good at search algorithms.
Okay, that's interesting. I think that's fascinating. I don't know if it's a good example, but it's sort of how human brains are fucking amazing. But if you ask the average person to multiply, 327 by 594, they're going to be like, fucking goddamn it. All right, give me a... let me, can I use my phone? No, can't use your phone. All right. And that's fascinating because a calculator is really goddamn old and simple technology and yet can do that so much better and faster than humans, with a few exceptions, can do. But, you know, so like, I don't think that's a knock on quantum computers per se. Like, they might be better at more difficult things, but the basic stuff, calculator stuff, you know, leave that to the calculators.
Or just different things. Yeah. I don't even know if I would call it more difficult. Like, to talk about human brains, like, humans are usually very good at recognizing faces. Like, yeah. Babies can recognize a face. And you ask a computer to do it, and all you have to do is look up any of those, and they can't see black people.
Right.
Because they didn't get that training data. You know, their computers are terrible at that sort of thing. It's just a difference, I would say, not a judgment call.
Yeah, that's fair. I guess it's hard to say, like, what's harder. I would think facial recognition is harder than number crunching, but I guess maybe there's no reason to even make that call. We'll just say different things. So for that reason, it's hard to say, yeah, we're in 1987 in terms of quantum computing, because you might be in, you know, 1603 in terms of number crunching, because quantum computers suck at that, but the year 2525 is still a lot in terms of something else, because quantum computers are very good at that something else.
Yeah, yeah, and there, I don't think we're really going to have, like, you're never going to have a quantum computer that works alone. It's always going to need a classical computer.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because we already have them. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe some aliens out there invented quantum computers first and are working really hard to make a classical computer.
That would be funny. Well, so, but I mean, roughly speaking, though, how can you give us a sense of how strong, if we're somewhere in the dozen, let's say the current record, just to stipulate for the sake of the conversation, is 10 qubits. How can you tell me how many Noah's Arks does that mean? No, like how powerful is that? Like, is there some way you can give us an indication, assuming that technology is working great? Like, someone's got that fridge. They cleared all the beer out, and they're like, this fucking fridge is 10 qubits and works perfectly. What do you think we could do with that right now?
Yeah. So right now, like, you'll see headlines a lot of, you know, so-and-so demonstrated quantum supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
And what you probably don't see is then 20 other people are complaining about that headline and getting really mad about it. But it's hard because there's no one benchmark. So what you'll have is, like, Google will come out and say, here's this algorithm that can only be done on a quantum computer. Hmm. And look, we did this out. We did this calculation that was theorized. And here was supposed to be the input. Here was the output. Look, we did it. Hooray us. In some cases, people will go, all right. And then they will figure out a way to do it on a classical computer. So then that kind of, you know, gets to the what's the point.
We got the John Henry situation.
Yeah. Or you'll have, you know, somebody go like, yeah, that's great. But the thing that you did can't scale to anything useful. Like, that's a cute quantum problem that you did. But there's no way to take that cute quantum problem and turn it into a real problem. These are the debates that people like to have behind doors.
And I would say that in general, it seems like humanity has gone the direction where the people who are like, oh, that's great, but what can you really do with it? They're pretty much always wrong, but like maybe not. So I guess the ultimate question I really have wanted to get at with this whole episode is, based on my conversations with you, I'm really wondering how much we've been sold a bill of goods, as they say, with quantum computing. Like, on a scale of 1 to Elon Musk's Hyperloop, how real is this? Is this the kind of thing where Elon Musk is going to keep promising us, like, oh yeah, we'll have quantum computing by the end of the day, actually, maybe by Friday, you know, and then it just never happens?
I hope he's not in quantum computing, is he? I haven't heard anything from him.
Yeah, he could. He couldn't do any harm, it sounds like.
There's already so much hype around everything that's quantum it's just a matter of time. And I think the thing is that there's a lot of hype, and a lot of that hype is probably not going to come true. But probably what will happen is going to be something that none of us have thought of right now, but it will be really cool. An analogy that comes up a lot with us is, like, we're in the days of ARPANET, where we're like, we're just going to build it and then see what we can do with it later.
And then it'll be made into porn, and that'll be...
Exactly. And nobody saw that coming. Nobody in 1970 was like, one day there will be Pornhub, and this will this will change movie theaters forever.
Yeah, only one Nostradamus was like, listen, I'm telling you, Porn will be on the computers. Yeah, that would probably be, there had
to be somebody.
They were laughed out of, but now they're the one laughing and masturbating. No. But nobody
saw like Instagram filters, you know?
Right, yeah.
Nobody saw that coming when they were thinking, hey, wouldn't it be cool to have two computers talk to each other?
Yeah.
And I think that's what's going to happen with quantum computers is that, and I'm a big believer in human creativity, mm-hmm. where it's like we...
And
we
capacity to create porn. Yeah, for sure.
That is true. where humans, like, we need to build things so that regular people can get a hold of them and start creating on them. Because what happened with computers. Like, right. I don't think we really had a big explosion until you had the personal computer or you had computers be accessible. Sure. And then all of a sudden, when you have a million people working on something, they
did
some amazing and terrifying things.
It's crazy. I mean, I know this is probably a weird example, but I see that just with like video games. It's fucking insane. Like a video game gets released. And back in the day when it was like Nintendo and like, you know, I watched my big brother play it, you know, it was like, oh, okay, he got on this level and it's impossible, can't really do it. And then you get to this day and age where like, actually, even some of those Nintendo games, like now that everybody can share everything and stream everything and work together and work on stuff, you come to find out that like, oh no, this person, they actually beat Mario 1 backwards with they're holding use two sticks and using two chopsticks for the buttons, and they beat the whole thing. Like the stuff people can do once everybody has gotten a hold of it and has no lives apparently is really amazing. I actually think it is, as funny as that example is, I actually think it's the same thing. Like it's crowdsourcing, but in a way that's just, it's so powerful. It's actually incredible.
Yeah. And I know there's a name for this when it's like, when people like, they can't do something. And then they hear that somebody else did it.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of a sudden they can do it without even seeing the solution. And I know there's a lot of like bullshit out there about it.
I used to do this exercise in college. I was an RA and we had this dorky exercise we'd do where it's like you give people a challenge and you tell them, okay, see if you can do this in, you know, 10 minutes or something. And then they do it. And then you're like, see if you can do it in, a minute. And then and just telling them that there's a different, like a better time threshold totally changes how they do it, and they figure it out like every time. It's really fascinating. I think that's the thing you're talking about. It's sort of like, I don't know if this is the same thing, but once someone ran a sub-4-minute mile, then like everybody could do it somehow. It's like that kind of thing. Once humans figure out it's possible, somehow they just do it. I don't really understand it. I still can't run a sub-7-minute mile, but whatever.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Okay, but let's pin this down a little bit, because the thing about like, oh, all our passwords are belong to us now because are not belong to us because the quantum computer is so powerful that like all the cryptography, all that crap's going to break down. How big of a threat is that? And if it sounds like you're saying that so far is not panned out or is not going to pan out, maybe, can you explain that a little bit?
Oh, I think that'll happen.
Oh, okay.
It's not happening right now. It might not happen in the next few years. But, you know, 10 plus years. Yeah, I think eventually we'll get to where we can have a quantum computer that can do that.
Oh, okay. Well, that's singing a different tune then from a minute ago. That sounds like a thing that quantum computers will do then.
What I was saying about like quantum computers taking over is like, I don't think they're like, you're not going to have where your personal computer is replaced with a quantum computer and everything's quantum and it's bigger, faster internet. And it does, you know, now your PlayStation 15 is a quantum machine.
Right.
But these niche capabilities, that's where quantum computers are going to do stuff is.
Yeah.
Like even breaking your passwords, that's very, very niche. That's because there's the way that we do cryptography now is based on what you call an asymmetric function. You have a function that's very easy to solve one way and very difficult to solve the other way. Okay. So like you're saying, the multiplying two large numbers together. For a computer, that's very easy to multiply those two together. It's very hard for it to factor them out. Like in, you know, middle school, high school algebra, where you had to do like the factoring of polynomials.
Yeah.
And you wondered, why am I doing this? This is so stupid. And it's like, that's what all of your bank accounts are based on.
Oh, wow.
That's what all your security is based on, is the ability to factor numbers.
Oh, because it's so hard to factor them out that like, I've learned a little bit about cryptography because it's so fucking interesting. I took a class, but it's also really difficult. It's the idea that like, it's easy to do those inputs. It's easy to multiply a bunch of numbers together, but then it's a lot harder to figure out precisely what was multiplied together necessarily. And that's kind of what you're saying, the asymmetrical. Yeah. Okay. But Pauly Shor's algorithm, you're saying.
Yeah, the Pauly Shor algorithm.
That's the one. That is the this. That's the all your passwords are belong to us one. But as of yet, is it a question of when you say no one's done that yet, is it a question of how many qubits they have or something about the qubits and how they're working that we haven't figured out? Like which part of that haven't we figured out?
I think it's mostly a scaling problem right now. All of the individual gates that you would need to do that have been shown and worked out. Not necessarily working together. So you don't just have a qubit scaling problem. You kind of have a sustainability problem. It all has to exist long enough in order to work. And what happens with the quantum computer, when I say long enough, is you get a lot of error in quantum computers right now. So there's significant places where these operations can and will go wrong. So then you have to do, you know, error correction on those. And that's another factor that's holding it back right now. I do think these are surmountable problems. I don't think they're going to get solved next week or maybe in 5 years, but eventually.
What's causing all the error? Is it a stability problem? Like it's just hard to keep everything stable in this sub-zero temperature smoky world?
Well, effectively. And that's why you want the cold temperature, because things are more stable at a cold temperature.
Right. That's what I meant. Sorry. So that's what creates that instability. Is there like a time record of like, here's how long we've kept a qubit going or something that gives us a sense of perspective there?
Yeah. And I believe it's a trapped ion, and in very, very special nursed circumstances, that I'm talking about an optical table filled with equipment and like three sleepless grad students nursing it. You're on the order of microseconds.
Wow, really? Is that long enough to like do anything? That's interesting. So again, trying to assess as a layperson, the problem here in terms of like, why isn't this real yet? Is it now? It sounds like it's a couple different things. It's like not only the stability and the time, but also the quantity of qubits. Is all those things together?
All these things together and more. Because you also have like the type of qubits that are good at lasting for a long time are maybe we don't have all the gates worked out for those. We don't really have a way to get a trapped ion qubit to talk to a superconducting qubit, you know, One lives in a cryostat. One lives on an optical table.
Oh, there's two. There's different kinds. Oh, okay. So there's different kinds. There's not one qubit. There's like several different kinds of them.
Yeah. And some are good at some things and some are good at other things. Geez. You know.
Roughly speaking, how many kinds of qubits are there that have been working or functional or that anyone's tried?
The ones that I know, superconducting qubits, which I believe are all Josephson junctions. So that's where you have like a superconductor metal and a little, very, very little insulator, and then another superconductor. And your specialness is in the electron flow, like across that insulator.
Hmm.
So I believe that's the only type of superconducting qubit, but maybe I'm missing one. So there's superconducting qubits, and then there's, you can have trapped ions, and then you can have photons. Oh, and I guess you could probably have spin qubits too. I mean, anything that can be in a superposition could be a qubit. I think all the major advancements for quantum supremacy at all are superconducting qubits. Those are the ones that are very, very cold. So all the advancements that you hear that this quantum computer did this amazing thing, like Google's quantum computer did something great, that's going to be something that lives in your friend Dilfridge's world. Okay. And the thing about those, that like those tend to be pretty stable, less prone to error because they're in a very confined environment. All qubits are fragile. That's kind of their nature. If they ever interact with anything, then that's going to collapse their superposition and ruin your whole thing.
They're real snowflakes, huh? They don't have any gumption.
They really are.
Why don't they just get a job?
They're so sensitive.
Yeah.
To any sort of perturbation.
So on one hand, it sounds like I'm getting two distinct messages. On one side of my brain, it's like, wow, this is super cool. It's only a matter of time before someone builds a Dilfridge that can hold enough cold beer that makes one of these. Or on the other hand, it's like, nah, this shit sucks and no one can do it at all. It's weird. I don't know which of those things it is.
Yeah, it's for if you're talking about one little tiny piece of something, like, you know, factoring a large number. I think a quantum computer that can do that will happen. I don't think that's going to end up being the coolest thing that quantum computers do. I think whatever they do is going to be, you know, we haven't figured that out yet. We have to actually have a quantum computer, like, you know, on a big enough scale for people to use it in order to know what it's going to be best for.
Right. But I feel like the principle of cracking all our passwords is pretty, that seems like kind of inevitable based on what you're saying.
Yeah. But crypto systems have been broken all the time.
I was going to ask, I assume people are working on this or if there's a system that is going to be so good at breaking it, can you use that same system to like make a better one or something?
Both and all together. Yeah. I mean, like there are people, hundreds of people at least, whose job it is not to make crypto systems. Not a lot of people. I mean, that they work on this like full time. This is their job.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you count the whole community, you definitely have thousands. The National Institute for Standards and Technology, they have a competition for a quantum safe cryptography. Mm. So post-quantum cryptography. This is a little bit of a misnomer because there's nothing quantum in it. So this is all math.
Yeah.
It's just math that is safe against a quantum computer. Okay.
So it doesn't rely on like the factoring thing that
nope.
stumps normal computers.
Yeah. Yeah. It relies on something totally different.
It relies on just like multiply 3 times 2. And the quantum computer's like, fuck, I can't, I'm out. That'd be funny if that you go the other way.
That actually kind of did happen. With one of the algorithms that was in this competition actually did get broken by a classical computer. And of course, like small circles of the internet went insane over that. They were like, see, this post-quantum stuff is so stupid. They made something that a quantum computer couldn't do, but somebody did it on their laptop. And
right.
But the point is that was kind of early in the competition. So what they have is a lot of, you know, people working on these algorithms, and they'll put out a competition where people, you know, in academia and in industry can come up with their systems, and they just, you know, red team the shit out of it until they get something that's solid. That's how they came up with our current system anyway. So people are working on this constantly. So the fact that, oh, it will all be broken, it's not like It's not like we made up a crypto system in 1900 and been using the same thing ever since.
Yeah. And it does. I mean, that eases my mind. It's not like Jack Bauer 24 situation where like some country full of people that are the color that America doesn't like is going to get a hold of one of these things. And then all our passwords are gone. Right. I mean, it feels like, although, I mean, this does sound like something that like is kind of a weapon. Like I would imagine that this would be something in terms of the bazillions of dollars we spend on, I don't know, jets that don't fucking fly or whatever, you know, nonsense. It seems like this would be a really good use, if there is a good use, of all the defense billions the U.S. spends on war. You know, like if this could be the next level of, we're already talking cybersecurity and, you know, Russian interference with all the blah, blah, blah. It feels like this kind of could be that next arena for that kind of stuff.
It's funny. Yesterday, I actually had this conversation with one of my coworkers who's a reservist, and he was joking about, you know, the military's current ads for recruiting, because they're all like cybersecurity.
Yeah.
Because that's what gets people excited. Nobody's excited by guns anymore. No, you're going to be typing on a computer, which is probably true.
Yeah, well, I think they are excited by guns, but we don't need those anymore. It'd be like advertising for like bayonet, you know, yeah, join the army and you're going to fire a cannon at somebody. It's like, no, I mean, yeah, cannons are still cannons, but it sounds like that's not the weapons of war that we're using anymore. It's interesting. What if it becomes a whole different, what if it totally switches? You know, typically it's like kind of Republican-y people are in, conservative people tend to be more military people. What if it switches over time and it's like, Republicans hate the military because it's a bunch of computer nerds, and then all like the left loves it. That'd be funny.
You know, I think we're already in that shift.
Wow.
Because people are so mad about the military being all woke, and it's like, yeah. Well, that's what makes it work better.
Yeah. Why don't we come to a close here? Is there anything else? I'm sure we got to, but a fraction of what you wanted to get to, because you had to contend with someone trying to understand what what this is. What else would you like to leave people with? So it sounds like don't be too worried about a quantum computer cracking your passwords tomorrow, but like eventually, but when that happens, I'm sure someone will be working on the other end to fix it. Is there anything else, any other messages that you want the average person to take away from this quantum computing 101 course here?
Yeah, I think what I really want to get across is that I know it's like the thing that quantum is hard, but it's not. It's, you know, actually the math to do quantum mechanics is easier than the math it takes to do classical physics.
Wow.
It's definitely not general relativity. That crap's out there. quantum mechanics is pretty easy. And
wow.
Actually, even quantum computing, it's linear algebra. The joke is that quantum mechanics is physicists reinventing linear algebra. So it's not that hard. It does take time to sit down and learn it.
Now, when you say what is that thing? Are you talking about the algorithms that make this stuff possible?
Yeah. Yeah. And even just understanding how to prove that something's in a superposition. You don't have to know a lot of fancy math. You have to know a little fancy math, but not a lot.
What math is considered fancy?
Like, you don't need to do like a really complicated, say, integral in calculus.
Oh,
or
I like those,
you know.
Yeah.
Those are fun. And boson ensembles are a lot of fun. But you don't really need that for quantum mechanics, or definitely not for the quantum computing side.
Well, I'm gonna take you up on this. I love math already. I want to look up how Pauli Shor's algorithm works. Would I be able to, as a person who's actually kind of good at math, would I be able to figure that out?
I would say start with Grover's algorithm.
Okay, I'll start with Grover. I'm curious because I'm going to go and I'm going to look at it and I'm going to be like, this is fucking impossible. And I'm going to call you out publicly. No. Or I'll figure it out and it'll be fun.
I bet that if you sat down for, you know, a few weeks, you could learn a good amount of quantum mechanics and be very comfortable with it.
Well, that's what's funny about this kind of thing. Like, I don't know how much quantum mechanics you need to know depending on what thing you're doing. You know, like if you're just working with like, okay, how do we use this logic gate? That's a little bit different than the person who's over there being like, how do I keep this beer so cold that, you know, isn't that kind of different jobs?
It is.
Like a programmer is a lot different than the person who, you know, came up with how to make a chip.
It really is. And it's really hard when you're working on trying to marry these things of of what works great on paper and what works great in the real world. And I would say like a bigger problem is making qubits that don't have to be so cold or making it easier to get so cold.
Especially with global warming. Can we do a warm qubit? Does anything work by being really hot I feel like that would be better.
No, but I mean, trapped ions and photons at least work at room temperature. Well, sort of. I mean, then the detector has to be cold. We're really stuck with
something
cold.
Always has to be cold. What is it about cold? Like, all right, I know we're trying to end, but like, actually, yeah. What is it about the cold that for some reason everything's got to be cold to work? I don't get it.
Well, there's two different sides of it. One is like efficiencies are always better in the cold because you don't have all the noise from thermal energy, which is really just stuff vibrating.
Hmm.
So like if you have a photodiode, it's going to work better when it's cold because it won't have, you know, the environment messing with it. The other side of it is superconductivity is just a really useful tool, and that only works when it's cold.
I should have asked you this a million years ago. What exactly is superconductivity? If you can explain it quickly, if not, then we'll just do it another time.
Yeah, it's when you have a metal that has zero resistance and it ejects a magnetic field.
Hmm. Okay. Well, more on that later, I guess.
Yeah, you put a voltmeter on something, you'll read, 20 ohms. You turn it into a superconductor, it will read zero. And then that gives you a really nice signal to work with because you had 20 ohms and now you have zero.
And because that's resistance, right?
Yeah.
And we don't like resistance is futile or not futile. Apparently resistance isn't futile. I don't know.
Resistance is the easiest thing to measure.
Well, we'll leave more on that for another time. I really appreciate this. This is super fascinating. I'm going to do some follow-up work and call you out on this being easy to understand. But I this was really helpful. And look, should the takeaway message be like, this is a little bit hyperloopy? Like this, what are you looking for? Okay, if I'm final question. If I'm just a guy, which I am, I see these headlines all the time about quantum computing and it makes it seem like, you know, tomorrow we're going to have a hyperloop. What should I actually be looking for? What will be a discovery or a thing or a accomplishment where you and person who we don't know, an anonymous governmenty person, will be like, oh shit, this means stuff's working now. Like we got it now.
I would say that it would be like, you know, a really good search algorithm. And, you know, you don't have to be afraid of it breaking your passwords. It could be the best logistics program out there that will actually make supply chains work efficiently or say distribute our power grid great. You know, if we could quickly figure out how to route power on a smart grid, that would be an excellent use for a quantum computer.
Right. But I get the uses. that's not what I'm saying. Like the uses sound amazing. It's more like, how will I know when somebody's actually done that? Like when somebody's made something. Is it in the fine print of these articles where it's like, yeah, so they made it work for like 0.0001 seconds. Is that the thing? What should I look for in this popular coverage?
I would look for when something's actually accomplished and it's not like where you have to interpret it on a graph. Like where it's, hey, look, we took this big number. Here are the factors. This is the result. You don't have to squint and look the other, you know.
Yeah. It made the Kessel run in less than 12 parsecs. And you're like, holy shit.
Yeah.
It actually did.
And you have the actual time and it says, oh, look, it did it in less than 12 parsecs. Not if you look at this graph sideways,
yeah. It will. Well, okay, that's helpful. But again, thank you so much for coming on. I know it sounds like there's not anything for you to plug because you seem to be pretty anonymous. I guess, but instead of plugging your social media, we'll all look directly into this flashy bulb thingy that's going to reset our memories of ever having heard this podcast, and we don't know who you are. But thank you so much for coming on. You're a delight, and you really did. I hope it didn't feel futile because you really did help me understand this better. But, you know, helping me understand something can be a tough process for some people.
Oh, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks.
All right. Thank you so much. Well, that was so much fun. What a great deep dive. And as you, I guess, heard in the last episode, since I did, you know, 20, 25 minutes, I have gone down the obsessive route on figuring out Grover's algorithm. And I think I like 87% understand it, believe it or not. I don't think it's worth trying to put into words because I think I need to like 100,000% understand it in order to relay it in a way that would be more helpful than not. I can say the words of what it is. I can say the words that I've read 10,000 times on 50 million different descriptions of Grover's algorithm. I can say those words, but I don't think I can rephrase them in my own words in a way that really helps. And like I said, I think I get it, but I actually am struggling with the implementation, like how it actually takes a real example and solves it. Like I get the theory and it's pretty cool. It's pretty remarkable. And I understand mathematically what it's doing, but I don't understand how you would actually start with an unsorted database, translate it into qubits, and then receive the answer and translate that back into classical information. Every example I see, like I'm actually looking it up and it's implemented, it starts with you knowing the answer. Like what, I'm literally looking in this quantum simulator right now for a 2-qubit example of Grover's algorithm, and it gives me 4 different examples depending on 4 different answers, because for 2 bits, there's obviously 4 different answers you could have, 0001, 1011. And it just gives you a different combination of quantum gates for each answer. So I don't understand how that doesn't mean you have to know the answer first before you apply the gate. So I'm struggling with a stupid part of it. I'm sure there's some obvious answer to that, but there you go. So I'm not going to call Anne out and say that it was impossible to understand this. I think it is possible. I think I encourage you to look up some quantum computing videos. They're really fun. Look up some tutorials. It's very complicated, but it's super duper cool. And I just want to thank Anne so much for kind of lighting that fuse of just enthusiasm that I've found for this topic. I'm still looking into it, even though this is long since recorded. I'm still just having so much fun. So fascinating. I can't believe that all this quantum stuff that just seems so magical, it's all true. It's all verified so solidly experimentally, and we just go about our day. It's so cool to me. This also, I think, encouraged other experts to make submissions. I saw, I don't know, like 4 or 5 new submissions, and I have a backlog, but I promise it will not go anywhere. As I said originally, it may be that I don't respond to your expert submission for like a year. And then one day in the year 2025 or something, I will email you and be like, hey, got to yours. And you will have been like 7th in line. but no, for real, like even if you haven't heard from me yet, and you almost everybody has not, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your submissions. And I will get to, like, I've looked at them and I've got too much good stuff. I've tumgus. I have too many good recordings. And so it's going to take a while to get through them, but they are there. They're not going anywhere. They are safely preserved. They are not in a qubit because that would only last like nanoseconds. They're safely stored away in regular bits, regular old ones and zeros, safe, good old reliable magnetic or whatever ones and zeros, however the magic works, ones and zeros. So another thank you to the experts who have submitted, and to the new experts, and to Anne for doing this episode, or these 2 episodes that really encouraged all that. I'm looking forward to coming back at you very soon with another episode or 2 before the month ends, and a bonus episode. So make sure to be on patreon.com/seriouspod, because that's how you will be the first to find out when that's up. So thank you so much for listening, everybody. Really appreciate it, and very much appreciate my patrons at patreon.com/seriouspod. You are the reason why I even exist right now, really. I mean, it's so important. It means so much to me that you folks have supported the show through all this. So thank you very much, and I'll see you very soon.